Redbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota on Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit toyotaonnicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com. Here on Breadbox Media, I'm your host, Pete Socks, a Catholic book blogger. And here with us today, we have Philip Waller. He's the editor of Catholic World News and is one of America's most incisive Catholic journalists and commentators. He's a graduate of Harvard College and has served as editor of Crisis Magazine, The Boston Pilot, and Catholic World Report. He's the author or editor of 10 books on political and religious topics. His essays, book reviews, and editorial columns have appeared in over 100 newspapers around the United States and abroad. Today, we'll be discussing his latest book, Lost Shepherd, How Pope Francis is Misleading His Flock. Welcome to the show, Phil Lawler.
Thank you for having me.
You're quite welcome. And so I want to get one thing out of the way as we get started today, and that is, why did you write this book? Because in the early pages of the book, you mentioned that it's not one that you necessarily wanted to write.
No, it's one that I would have preferred not to write. But I reached a point at which I felt that almost an obligation to write it, because I recognized that so many people were feeling the same way I was feeling but were at sea, that they were dismayed by what they heard from Rome. They were disoriented by some of the things Pope Francis was saying, and they were wondering whether they were all wrong, whether the Catholic faith had changed, or what was it that was happening in Rome, because it was something that we haven't experienced in our lifetime. And I thought that these people needed help in clarifying things and clearing up an awful lot of confusion and distress.
And that's going to be one of the key focuses of our talk today, is that confusion. And when he was first elected, we had what was coined as the Francis effect. And,
yes,
you know, we get this Pope who's different than what we're used to, and there's a lot of hype surrounding him after his election, especially in the areas of reform. And in the beginning of Lost Shepherd, you mentioned how you, like many others, were excited about this election of Pope Francis. So as time went on, what were some of the key factors that changed for you?
Well, if I could just go back a little bit. Before Pope Francis was elected, when Pope Benedict XVI resigned, I was predicting, or I should say I was warning people, that we were going to have a change, and a dramatic change, because for more than 30 years, we had had these two back-to-back popes, John Paul II and Benedict XVI, both of whom were just extraordinary teachers and first-class intellectuals, world-class intellectuals, with the background in academic life and a real gift for expressing things with clarity and depth. And that's, frankly, not normal. I mean, you can't assume that the Pope is going to be, as Benedict was, the most influential Catholic theologian of the century. That's not normal. So it was only natural to expect something different. And with Pope Francis, we definitely got something different. And at first, like so many other people, I was excited by the difference. He had a style, informal style that was attractive, had its charm. He did things, said things in a way that people weren't accustomed to seeing and hearing. And so he had an awful lot of people, including a number of my friends and acquaintances, talking about the faith for the first time in a long time. And it was all very exciting. There were big crowds in St. Peter's Square. There were a lot of people just talking about Catholicism, and this was all terrific. Then, as time went by, I started noticing, and eventually others started noticing, that some of these things that he was saying were not just provocative, but mystifying, confusing. They weren't in line with what the Church has traditionally said and taught. And Pope Francis had said, even before he was elected, in interviews, he had admitted that he tends to be impulsive and disorganized. And so you say, okay, so occasionally he shoots from the hip, and like most people who shoot from the hip, makes mistakes. Mm-hmm. But then I also noticed that the mistakes all seem to tend in one direction, towards a more liberal vision of Catholicism, more acceptance of secular culture, and in a way that makes Catholics uneasy.
Yeah. And, you know, to look back on that day when he was elected and compare him 5 years later to what we had, it's almost like it's seemingly a different person of sorts. Because when he came out on the loggia after being elected, he almost had this sense of astonishment, sort of a deer in the headlight look, like whoa, I'm whoa, you know?
Sure. Well, I think anyone after 5 years grows into the role and becomes accustomed to it, and anyone who's elected Pope is I'm sure going to be stunned and at sea for quite a while. But now he's more at ease, he's accustomed to his role, and after all these months you start recognizing the real personality. Mm-hmm. And some of the personal traits come out, and some of them are concerning.
And it's interesting to me that here we are doing this interview 5 years later, and in the years since his election, we no longer hear about the Francis effect, and the crowds have somewhat diminished in St. Peter's Square. And I was recently reading an article that actually pointed out that the crowds are actually lighter than what his predecessors were seeing when they were in the pontificate. So it seems that in more than one way, this difference is being noticed.
No question about that. When Pope John Paul was elected, those of us who are old enough to remember, there was a similar sensation, and there were the crowds that were huge in St. Peter's Square, and that just kept going. You know, pretty much throughout his pontificate until the very end when he was too sick to move around, too sick and too weak. But throughout his pontificate, John Paul II would command huge crowds and excite people, and not just in an emotional way, because you see the results even now in so many young priests who will tell you that they were inspired by seeing him at World Youth Day or something like that. With Pope Francis, you had the novelty, and I don't mean to dismiss that. I mean, I think it was a breath of fresh air. Mm-hmm. But that once that wore off, the effect has really not been very strong at all. And you're right, the crowds in St. Peter's Square are now the lowest they've been in 30 years. And you get the sense of a missed opportunity, that there was an awful lot of excitement based on an expectation that he would carry out a great program of reform. And 5 years later, we're still sort of waiting for that reform to get underway.
Mm-hmm, definitely. For me personally, the eyebrow raising began with the off-the-cuff airplane interviews, and specifically the now infamous "Who am I to judge?" quote when he was speaking about homosexuals, and the reporter basically asked this question out of nowhere. He responded, and the secular press latched on to his response, and not surprisingly so. It was spoken out of turn, unprepared. So we've gone from a pontificate of Benedict XVI, who was a very formal, by-the-book leader, to a man who comes from a Latin American country, finds himself on a world stage he's unaccustomed to. Why wouldn't the folks in the Vatican control these situations rather than having to face damage control afterwards?
That's a good question, and I've asked it several times aloud. I guess the simple answer is that he's the boss. And if he wants to give airplane interviews, then he's going to give airplane interviews. But some of the interviews that he's given really make me shake my head. For instance, the interviews with, is it Eugenio Scalfari, mm-hmm. who is an Italian journalist. He is a Marxist, an atheist, and he's over 90 years old. And he doesn't take notes. He doesn't record his interviews. He goes back after an interview and writes up what he remembers the person to have said. And if I were the PR man for the Vatican, I would say, you're never coming here again.
Yeah.
Because that's a formula for disaster when he is giving his version of what he thinks the Pope said. That's just a recipe for trouble, particularly when you know that he is not of the same sort of mindset as the Pope. But yeah, you ask a very good question. Why not eliminate the problem rather than constantly playing catch up and issuing clarifications? That it mystifies me.
Mm-hmm.
Back when he was in Buenos Aires, then Cardinal Bergoglio told a journalist, he didn't like to do interviews, and he said, told the journalist, if you want to know what I think, read my homilies. And the reason being, he said he didn't think he was very good in interviews, and I'm sorry to say, he was right.
Yeah. Which just adds more to the mystery. With that, we're going to take a quick break. We have lots more to talk about. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Redbox Media, and we'll be right back. Catholic solution to the healthcare problem is here. Paying too much for your healthcare costs? Solidarity HealthShare is a healthcare sharing ministry which provides an ethical way to fund healthcare costs while protecting and practicing our Catholic beliefs. Best yet, Solidarity HealthShare's members are exempt from the fines and penalties in the Affordable Care Act. For more info, call 844-313-4999. Again, that's 844-313-4999, or visit SolidarityHealthShare.org. That's SolidarityHealthShare.org. Things I want to clarify up front for those who have not read the book and who are wondering what it's about. I think the one thing we need to clarify that you point out in this book is that the Pope is not necessarily preaching heresy. And you also point out that you, like many, are praying daily for him.
Absolutely. Heresy is a specific offense, and people toss it around. People toss around terms like heresy and excommunication a bit too lightly. Heresy is a particular offense which involves preaching openly against the Catholic doctrine. And Pope Francis has not done that. Pope Francis has said things that appear to be straining, difficult to reconcile with Catholic doctrine, but he certainly never attacked openly. In fact, he invariably will insist, if he's pressed, that he is a loyal son of the Church and he would never attack a Catholic doctor.
Mm-hmm. So let's set some groundwork here as we discuss further some of the points you raise in the book. And that is, one of the things you state is one of the documents that led to your concerns is, or was, Amoris Laetitia. And for those unfamiliar with that document, what is that document about?
It's called an apostolic exhortation. It's the product of a meeting of the Synod of Bishops, which is an advisory body of bishops from all over the world. In fact, this was a sort of double-decker session. There were two sessions on the family. And at the end of the two sessions, Pope Francis prepared this document, Amoris Laetitia, which is meant to reflect and summarize the work of the Synod. And you're right, this is the document that sort of put me over to the edge. This is a document that made me think I really cannot continue to do what I had previously been doing, which is trying to show how the Pope's statements could be reconciled with what the Church has always taught. And this document, I couldn't do it anymore.
Right. Now, in Amoris Laetitia, being that it was ground zero for your shift, what troubled you most about the document?
Well, there was a lot, frankly, that troubled me about the document. As the saying goes, there was a good deal of good that was good in it, and there was a good deal that was new, but what was good wasn't new, and what was new wasn't good. Let me confine myself to two things. First, the document suggests throughout that fidelity in marriage is an ideal that nobody can really live up to, that we all fall short of it. And that troubles me because you could say that, okay, perfect love, perfect spousal love is an ideal that nobody fulfills. But if by fidelity you mean you don't commit adultery, that's not an ideal. That's something that quite a few people fulfill. And to suggest that a break in Catholic teaching on marriage is justified because we all fall short of the ideal is sort of an insult to the countless millions of faithful couples who have at least been faithful to each other throughout their marriages. The other thing, the bigger picture problem, or the more specific problem, is this. Throughout the two meetings of the Synod of Bishops, the topic that everyone was discussing, at least in the outside world, was whether the Church would allow Catholics who are divorced and remarried to receive communion.
Right.
And throughout history, the answer to that question has been no. And in Amoris Laetitia, Pope Francis appears to be saying a qualified yes. He never quite comes out and says it. It's buried, the message is buried between the lines and in one controversial footnote. And different bishops have interpreted it in different ways, some saying that the traditional teaching and discipline of the Church has not changed, some saying that it has. So you have profound confusion throughout the Catholic world on marriage and the Eucharist, which are two of the most central points in Catholic life.
Mm-hmm. What I think is interesting about the whole situation is all of this could be resolved, all of the questioning taking away, if Pope Francis would simply answer the dubia, the legitimate questions that the four cardinals posed, asking him to clarify his stance in that document. And to this point, he refuses to do that. He's almost taking the, as we discussed earlier, the stance with the airplane interviews, I'm the boss, I don't have to answer that. But wouldn't it seem, just to clear it all up and make it go away, you'd want to answer those questions?
It would certainly seem that way if what you want is clarity. And here is where, again, I can just no longer defend what the Pope is doing, because the only way I can read his silence, his refusal to answer requests for clarification, is that he wants a lack of clarity. And why would you want a lack of clarity? The only reason I can think of is because you want to give people a fudge factor, a maneuvering room to get around the traditional discipline. And I think, as I see it, Pope Francis doesn't want to come out and say explicitly what he thinks, what he wants, because he knows that would be contradicting the constant teaching of the Church, and that would provoke an uproar from other bishops, and he's not ready to go there. Mm-hmm. But he is ready to create this confusion that gives liberal prelates enough room to maneuver and establish, sort of fait accompli, where everyone is changing Eucharistic discipline, even though it isn't specifically authorized.
Right. So essentially, in some sense, he is inadvertently, perhaps, leading us down that road of a different form of teaching from the Church that may take years to come to fruition if it does come to that.
That's right, and I think it will take years to undo the damage, because so many people will believe that the Church has changed its teaching. I should say here also that in the last few weeks since the book has come out, I've had a lot of people ask me questions about hasn't the Church changed its teaching on this or that subject? And I say, no, nothing has changed there, but there's a sort of general impression out there that everything is up for grabs. Mm. And that, too, is just adding tremendously to the confusion.
And what do you think in your experience of writing this book and the research you did, what do you think's the end game of that confusion? What's the goal? What's the strategy? What's the point of it, really?
Well, the way the Church behaves, practice follows preaching, and vice versa. And if the formal teaching has not changed, but the actual practice on the ground in the parishes has changed, then it almost doesn't matter what the teaching is. People come to accustom themselves to a new attitude, and most people don't spend a whole lot of time reading the catechism or reading theology textbooks. So the doctrine could be lost for all practical purposes, and people just wouldn't allude to it.
That's a good point. We're going to take another quick break. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Redbox Media, and we'll be right back. Consumer-driven world where we're told we need and deserve more, Susan Muto, Executive Director of the Epiphany Association, reminds us that gratefulness is a gift from God. In Gratefulness, the Habit of a Grace-Filled Life, she reveals that grateful living is not another new fad, but has been the way of saints and Christian mystics for centuries. In this insightful, inspiring book, she explores how life-changing a spirit of gratefulness can be by using both personal and well-known examples of the struggles and rewards of grateful living. Find Gratefulness by Susan Muto at AveMariaPress.com or look for it wherever books and e-books are sold. to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. We have with us here today Philip Lawler speaking about his book, Lost Shepherd, How Pope Francis is Misleading His Flock. And there's a lot of stuff here to consume. Great book, by the way. Interesting book. Well-researched. And the one thing I want to bring up, and we were talking about confusion and why it's being sown and whatnot, and the question that I have often thought is there's been talk that this perhaps isn't totally all Pope Francis himself, but rather the issue may be with those the Pope has surrounded himself with. How much do you feel this is coming directly from Francis, and how much is likely coming from his inner circle?
It's impossible to say. As the old political saying goes, personnel is policy, and the people you choose to help you, if you're the leader, that's an indication of what you want. So, and or to put it differently, another political slogan, what Harry Truman had on his desk, the buck stops here. Ultimately, the Pope is responsible for what comes over his desk, whether or not he wrote it or was the first one to think it. There is no question in my mind that he is surrounded by some advisors whose ideological or theological tendencies are very liberal, I think more liberal than those of the Pope himself, but he chose them. So, ultimately, it's his product.
Right, right. And what I find interesting is I'm a convert, converted in 96, so I've been with three popes, John Paul Benedict, now Pope Francis. And even before becoming Catholic, I was obviously familiar with Pope John Paul because he was such a big figure in the world. For the first time in my life, I see political machinations within the church that I have not witnessed before in this pontificate. And, you know, we're throwing out the word liberal, conservative, and talk like that didn't seem to happen too much prior to this pope.
Well, there's always a certain amount of skullduggery going on in the Vatican, and that's one of the reasons that people were looking forward to a period of reform. But I would agree with you that during this pontificate, it has been more blatant. I discuss in the book what I call the enemies list.
Yes.
The people who are perceived to be critics of the Pope, or people who are perceived to be resisting his initiative, are being treated really quite roughly. We have several instances of members of the Roman Curia who have been summarily dispatched, and without the finesse that has happened in the past, there are always personnel shuffles, but some of these have been pretty harsh. And the Pope's advisors have taken to the social media to denounce his critics or their own critics. And the most aggressive of them all, a Jesuit priest by the name of Father Anthony Spadaro, has been denouncing anyone who disagrees with him and claiming the disagreement with him, with Father Spadaro, is an attack on the Pope and should be punished.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had, a lot more hardball, put it that way, in
right.
this pontificate.
In that chapter you discuss allies and enemies, you bring up you quote Pope Francis from an address he gave in 2015 when he was in the United States, where he says harsh and divisive language does not befit the tongue of a pastor, has no place in his heart, although it may momentarily seem to win the day, only the enduring allure of goodness and love remains truly convincing. And as you just pointed out, that doesn't necessarily seem to be the behavior of the inner workings of this pontificate. One example I can think of is Cardinal Burke. He's removed.
Right.
He's put off in this out-of-the-way area, and then he's pulled back into the Vatican a little while later. These moves not only seem like they're a vengeful or silencing mechanism, but they don't make sense.
Well, yeah, and Pope Francis himself, I mean, frankly, he is not one to talk about the use of harsh language, because as I was writing this book, as I set out to write this book, he was giving a series of homilies in his daily masses at the Doma Sancta Martha in the Vatican. And day after day after day, he would denounce people. He would say, you know, these are the Pharisees, the doctor of the law, the people with hardened hearts, people who have no room in their hearts for God, who are hypocritical. It was day after day. I felt like I was being pummeled.
Right.
And that was pretty harsh, and it was pretty divisive. It was very definitely a sort of us versus them mentality.
It's kind of ironic coming from the same Pope who made the comment, "Who am I to judge?" to be giving such homilies, pummeling others,
yeah.
In some sense.
Yeah, and in Amoris Laetitia, the document that we were discussing earlier, he speaks a great deal about accompanying people who are in difficult or irregular situations. You'd think, well, okay, then you should accompany people who disagree with you about global warming or about economic policy, you know, which are not key issues
right.
in Catholic doctrine. But there seems to be very little tolerance for those people because they're not with the agenda.
Right. Now, I want to bring something up here, and it's definitely a conversation point that we need to look at, and it's to root this pontificate in the larger context of world history. My good friend Mike Aquilina wrote a book a few years ago entitled Good Pope, Bad Pope, Their Lives Are Lessons, and in that he brings up the fact that irregardless of how bad a pope has been, and as you and I are well aware, there have been plenty of bad ones, less than stellar ones, none have been able to break the church, so to speak. So based upon that, where does Pope Francis fall in this scheme of world history?
Oh, I'm not going to even try to tackle that. I'll let the historians do that 30 years from now, maybe. But let me say this much. One of the key reasons that I wrote the book is because I recognized that people were upset with Pope Francis, and some were really badly overreacting. I've had friends who have fallen into the trap of thinking, oh, he's the anti-pope.
Yeah.
He's not the legitimate pope. There must be something, you know, that maybe the election was invalid, or he has ceased to be pope because he's preaching heresy. All of these wild ideas, which, by the way, are not accepted by any of the key players, whether you look to Pope Emeritus Benedict or Cardinal Burke, all of them will assure you that Francis is the legitimate pope. There is no other. However, you have to ask yourself, what are the possibilities here? One is he's a good pope, in which case we have to reconcile what he's saying with church teaching over the centuries prior to him, which I can't do. Or we say he's not the pope, he's an anti-pope, and if you do that, you're floating off into conspiracy theory and actually very dangerous territory. And the third is he's not such a good pope. And once you realize that that looks like the most likely alternative, then you say, oh, okay, well, Catholic history tells us this has happened before, and the church has survived, and the church will survive. It's a time of testing right now where we have to stand up and try to eliminate the confusion ourselves by our own clarity, but we'll survive. To some extent, I want people to calm down.
Mm-hmm. Yes. We're going to take one more quick break. We'll come back and wrap this up. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media, and we'll be right back.
We want to help others, especially in places of strife, such as the Holy Land, where Christianity is dwindling by the day. But how to help? Here's an easy way. Buying products through the Holy Land gift shop. Every product you purchase at myfranciscan.org/shop helps Christians support their families and stay in the Holy Land. Olive wood, embroidery, spices, and many more authentic products from the Holy Land are available right now at myfranciscan.org/shop. The Holy Land gift shop, bringing the Holy Land and home.
Lot of ground so far, and one thing I want to talk about this last segment, and I want to I believe it needs bearing, and I say this to commend you, Phil, because your book is thoughtful, it's very well thought out, it's not filled with exaggeration or fluff, and I walked away after reading this book with a sense that you genuinely have concerns, but you do not want to embellish them. It's a very sensitive topic to write about, and again, I commend you for trying to bring some clarity to the situation, shall we say.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Now, with all of the talk 5 years ago about Pope Francis being the Pope of Reform, and we've just said this already, we are actually seeing very little of that. And in recent weeks, we're seeing a Pope who seems to have quieted down a bit. He has a swirling issue that keeps popping up over this letter relative to a priest abuse scandal in Latin America that he either did or didn't receive, depending upon who you speak with. He has issues cropping up with the Vatican Bank that continues to raise their ugly head the past 5 years. And when he's spoken in recent months, he alludes to his age and his energy and ability to continue. So, hypothetically speaking, I think it has to be asked, are we headed into an unprecedented period where we have three living popes at once?
God help us, I hope not. it's confusing having two. And Pope Benedict has been a model of a retired pope in that he has kept to himself. He hasn't made public statements except about his own scholarly work, and even then, only a very few. It would be very confusing now if Pope Benedict were weighing in on all sorts of public issues.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I just can't imagine a Pope Emeritus Francis who would be equally quiet and equally careful about his public statements. I mean, we know that he likes to talk, and that he sometimes talks out of turn.
Yes.
And to have, you know, to have another emeritus pope and one who is given to public statements, to ill-considered public statements, I think would be terribly confusing.
Yes, if not just an outright disaster. One of the things that occurred recently that really, really bothered me is when Pope Francis loosened the restrictions on the liturgy and is allowing local bishops to interpret, essentially interpret the Mass under their own viewpoints, which totally reverses the work of Benedict XVI before him to bring everyone under a unified liturgical structure. What are your thoughts on that?
It's worrisome, but it's funny how the tables have turned in the last 5 or 10 years. About, well, let me make it 10 or 15 years ago, I was delighted to have virtually any question settled by Rome rather than by the American bishops, because I was confident that Rome would do a better job. And I no longer have that confidence. In that regard, I'm not as upset as I might have been. The other factor here is the question of translation. It does make a certain amount of sense that the authorities on translation of the liturgy would be those who are native speakers of the language. Having said that, in the past, any translation had to get an okay from the Vatican. And I think that was a very wise rule because it prevented one conference of bishops from going too far in deciding that its own translation would, vary from what the Universal Church is actually doing.
Mm-hmm. Of your book, I found the last chapter to be really, really meaty, actually, the chapter Tradition in the Balance, because you really go into looking kind of hypothetically at the situation we're currently in. And one of the things in there you talk about is the moral duty of bishops. And you bring up the fact that only four cardinals stepped forward to ask these questions about Amoris Laetitia. And, you know, why not more? Obviously, the questions these four cardinals were asking were legitimate questions of concern. Why do you believe more didn't step forward?
It's a good question. I think that a lot of bishops have become accustomed to looking to Rome for guidance and assuming that their job is to help get across whatever it is that's coming from Rome. And then, to some extent, there are a lot of bishops who are cowed by the pressure tactics that we have seen, that we were discussing earlier, from the Pope and his associates, and worried that if they appear to be in open conflict with the Holy Father, that they will pay a price for it. To which I say, well, sorry, but then you've got to pay a price. That's what your red vestments are for. It's mm-hmm. an indication of a willingness to shed blood. And it may be that what will come out of this pontificate that's positive is that we'll recognize that for too long, diocesan bishops have not fulfilled their job, their role and responsibility as teachers of the faith. Your diocesan bishop he's the boss in your diocese, and it's wrong if he's constantly referring questions over to Rome. Today, when a whole lot of honest, faithful Catholic people are confused, we really need diocesan bishops to help them with that confusion by stating clearly what the Church teaches. If that involves implicit criticism of the Pope, well, then I believe that that, too, is part of their duty.
And now we've discussed the bishops. What is our role as a laity in all of this confusing period of time?
Well, first, to pray. You can always pray for the Pope, and you can always pray for the Church, and you can pray for the victory of clarity and honest, authentic doctrine. Then, too, I think that lay people have a responsibility, and clergy and religious have a responsibility to demand clarity so that we ask our pastors, please tell us exactly what the Church teaches and be clear about it, and don't let yourself be distracted or intimidated or put off by what is coming out of Rome. Tell it like it is.
Phil, I want to thank you for taking time out of your schedule today and spending it with us. Can you tell people where they can find your book and others you've written, but specifically this one, Lost Shepherd, How Pope Francis is Misleading His Flock?
Well, you can find it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble online, and then I hope it's available at a bookstore near you, and if it isn't, please ask them to order it, Lost Shepherd.
Excellent. Any closing thoughts?
I'd just like to say that the important point that I try to make in the book is that the Pope should be a focus of unity. So the fact that he is causing division is really a betrayal of his mission.
Again, thanks for spending time with us, Phil. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Redbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. And until next time, God bless.
I learned how many people we could help and how good you feel after you've helped others.
I know Lent is about giving, so I want to give.
These kids are talking about CRS Rice Bowl, a Lenten program known by generations of Catholic families. Children love it because they experience different cultures and gain a lasting impression of the people they are helping. You can bring CRS Rice Bowl into your home and experience the joy of seeing your children or grandchildren find new meaning in Lent. Visit CRSRiceBowl.org to get started.
Rice Bowl inspired me to pray more and to pray for those who are less fortunate.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media. Find more about us at breadboxmedia.com.